If you have any information about the disappearance of Alicia Navarro, please call the Glendale, Arizona Police Department at 623-930-3000, the Anti-Predator Project at 305-796-4859, or you can email me, Alyssa Fleck, at gonefromglendale@gmail.com. If you think you see Alicia, please call 911 immediately. I have a request for my listeners, which may sound strange, but please bear with me. I want to ask anyone who's listening to please not go real life. And by that I mean, please do not contact Alicia's family. Please do not contact Alicia's mother, her stepfather, or her friends. I'm so glad that you care about this case. I obviously care about it too. For some context you might not be aware of, Alicia's mother is contacted by literally hundreds of people a week who have questions about the case or theories of what happened or their own ideas of how to investigate Alicia's disappearance. As much as she appreciates that people care, this has been happening for over 3 years. So just take a second to think about how many people that is. It's absolutely overwhelming. And as important as your opinion about this case is, after 3 years, a theory that is new to you is not new to Alicia's mother. And Alicia's mother never asked for any of this to happen to her. If you want to talk about the case or offer theories, I strongly encourage you to use Reddit. I use it daily to dissect cases and bounce ideas off of other smart folks who care about unsolved cases. There's a great community of smart, like-minded people there. You can also join this podcast's Facebook group, which is called the Gone from Glendale Podcast Discussion Group, and where I'm more than happy to talk to listeners about their theories. This episode is not appropriate for all listeners and contains subject matter that may be disturbing to some listeners. Please take care. Every day, Alicia's mother, Jessica, wakes up and nervously scrolls through the news on her phone. She sees stories about human remains found in garbage dumps, on hiking trails, in mass graves. Alicia's DNA is in a nationwide database that ensures her DNA will be checked against any unidentified human remains that are discovered. But that's a process that takes longer than it does for the discovery of human remains anywhere in the nation to hit the news. Anytime those stories hit the news, hundreds of people, well-meaning friends and strangers alike, forward the stories on to Jessica. Jessica's heart drops as she wonders, is this it? Is today the day? She opens the news story with a click, her heart racing frantically as she scrolls. It's not. Today it's someone else's child who was found, but Jessica knows she'll go through this again. Maybe as soon as tomorrow. Sometimes the news stories have happier endings. But even then, they're not happy. Jessica's life has been starkly divided between life before Alicia disappeared and life after. Her trust in the world has been shattered. Her daughter Alicia has been missing for more than 3 years. She was just 14 when she vanished in the middle of the night, and I've spent the last 4 episodes telling you that story from different angles and perspectives. When she was first asked about whether something in Alicia's life had changed that would cause her to run away, Alicia's mother Jessica couldn't think of anything specific. But with the benefit of hindsight, Jessica now believes Alicia seemed borderline paranoid in the months leading up to her disappearance, which at the time she'd considered an extension of Alicia's social anxiety, autism, and general teen angst. Alicia had seemed concerned about being followed by a vehicle, or being tracked while riding in one particular family vehicle. Alicia's friends from middle school and one of her gamer friends, Clark, said Alicia sometimes made outlandish claims that they didn't take seriously, or talked about people they weren't sure existed. But now it seems like Alicia might have had a very good reason to be afraid. Alicia might have had a very good reason to believe she was being followed in some manner of speaking. And while it's terrifying to imagine being followed, it's perhaps more terrifying to imagine someone who has disguised themselves as someone who is safe to run to. This is Gone from Glendale, Episode 5, Secret Lives and Midnight Productions. According to Brad Dennis, the National Search Director for Class Kids National Center for Missing Children, children run away for one of two reasons. They run from something, or they run to something. I would argue in many cases it's some combination of the two. The FBI has reported seeing a significant increase in recent years in the sextortion of young girls, particularly 10 to 15-year-olds, online. Sextortion is a form of blackmail, where offenders victimize children by getting them to send compromising material that can be used against them. Extortionists use this blackmail to escalate their demands against the young victim, who thinks they are to blame. The paranoia Alicia displayed in the year leading up to her disappearance, along with other anomalies from that time period, could have indicated someone was trying to gain Alicia's trust in order to extort her. What others saw as extreme anxiety or outlandish claims could have been a real fear of someone who threatened Alicia and told her no one would believe her. Of course, this is speculation, just like any other theories of who took Alicia, since we have no evidence of what actually happened to her. Almost exactly 2 weeks before she went missing, on September 1st, 2019, Alicia went to Metro Center Mall in Phoenix with Jack and Cody, two boys who I talked about in greater detail in episode 4. Jack and Cody are not their real names, but one of them is a minor, and neither of them has agreed to talk to me or participate in this. Alicia had been dating both boys at the same time, without the boys' knowledge, and both respectively dumped her sometime after that mall outing to Metro Center. This is all information that came out to Alicia's mother, Jessica, after Alicia disappeared. She did not know Alicia even had one boyfriend. Jessica dropped Alicia off at the mall that day and picked her up again a few hours later. The boys would later separately tell investigators that Alicia had a flip burner phone that day, which she said she used to call her parents. Jessica had never seen Alicia with a burner phone. If Alicia did have a burner phone, maybe one with Uber on it, where did she get the phone? How did someone give it to her? Alicia hardly went anywhere alone, or at all. The mall outing and another outing to a friend's quinceañera were some of the first real social outings Alicia had ever had, according to Jessica. Whoever lured Alicia from home might have given her a burner phone and other gifts in the months leading up to her disappearance. In other episodes, I've speculated that whoever took Alicia might have known the area she lived in, and in episode 1, I mentioned the golf ball-sized hole that appeared in Alicia's bedroom window screen in the months before she disappeared. If whoever had lured Alicia from home had given her gifts in the past, I expect Jessica probably would have found those gifts, but then again, maybe not, and any gifts Alicia might have received could definitely be a lead. On Friday, September 13th of 2019, 2 days before her disappearance, Alicia told her mother she wasn't feeling well because of her anxiety and asked to stay home from school. But when her mother saw her on the stairs at 1 a.m. on Sunday the 15th, Alicia seemed giddy and excited, not the demeanor of someone scared of whoever was coming to get her. In episode 3, Alicia's gamer friend Clark Samples posited that Alicia could have thought she was running to her own Prince Charming. Three of Alicia's close friends, and only those three from what I can tell, agreed she'd talked about running away to California or Australia. I think the mentions of California and Australia are important, but I don't know why. Yet. In this episode, I'll be continuing through the second part of the Glendale Police case file on Alicia's disappearance, which I started examining in the last episode. I'll also be scratching the surface on a shady organization I've been hearing rumors about since first becoming involved with Alicia's case, that I'll be covering in greater detail in future episodes. I've expressed some thoughts on the police case file itself in past episodes, but I want to mention here that while I don't have the complete case file, the case file I do have, in addition to having significant redactions and typos, is also not in chronological order. And sightings are repeated in the case file in a way that actually makes it really hard to tell if it's a reference to a previous sighting or a brand new one. So I'm doing my best to make sense of this document, but I just want to let you know that almost every page leaves me with more clarifying questions. On September 20th, 2019, which is Alicia's 15th birthday, Jessica hosts a grim birthday party for her missing daughter, who has now been missing for 5 days. Jessica gets that red velvet cake that Alicia asked for before she disappeared. Amidst friends and family surrounding a park picnic table, Jessica lights the candles as she begs through tears for her daughter to come home. On September 21st, 6 days after Alicia vanishes in the middle of the night, Glendale Police Officer M. Carrasco responds to a call from a self-storage facility on 43rd Avenue in Palmare, where an employee says they have footage from the night of Alicia's disappearance that they want a police officer to review. The storage unit is about a mile away from Alicia's house. Officer Carrasco responds to what I believe was the StoreQuest self-storage unit on 43rd Avenue in Palmare, where an employee had two short clips queued up that she wanted the officer to watch. This call is interesting because StoreQuest is just one block from La Pradera. La Pradera is the park where Alicia had allegedly been seen on the 19th with a black male with facial tattoos, 4 days after she went missing. The sighting has since been called into question, and it does seem counterintuitive for an abductor to keep Alicia so local, unless they didn't have the means to move her, which I highly doubt. One of the surveillance clips the employee wanted Officer Carrasco to watch is from 5:16 a.m. on September 15th. This would be less than 2 hours after it's believed Alicia snuck out the back door and walked down the front driveway. Carrasco notes that the footage shows a female walking northbound along 43rd Avenue by herself. Because of the low quality of the footage, Carrasco can't tell if this is Alicia. But he sees that the woman walks past a traffic barricade pole. So Carrasco goes outside, locates the same pole, and measures it. Based on the height of the pole, Officer Carrasco figures the woman from the footage measured about 5'2", a few inches more than Alicia, and he rules that woman out. However, the police file here notes Alicia's height as being 4'3". The missing posters Alicia's mother approved and the official media reports all put Alicia's height at 4'5". I'm noting this small inconsistency to point out how easy it is to make a small mistake in the police case file, a file that easily has had 20 to 30 officers add supplemental reports. Small mistakes and clerical errors really do add up. The next clip the employee wanted the officer to watch was from a bit earlier in the night. At approximately 4:28, about an hour after it's believed Alicia went missing, two males walk by the storage unit that's a mile from Alicia's home with a child that's about 3 feet tall. Due to the quality of the footage, Carrasco again can't tell if this child is male or female. He has the employee copy the footage. The next event in the police file is an interview between Detective Sanchez, the lead investigator on the case at this point, and Alicia's biological father who was living in Florida. Her father, Jaime Navarro, traveled to Glendale for the interview, and he tells Sanchez about his relationship with Jessica and Alicia. He says that he calls Alicia sometimes, but she doesn't answer, and they don't have much of a relationship. About a year prior, he bought and sent Alicia a necklace, the last gift he gave her. He says Jessica told him Alicia went missing and called him on Sunday, but hasn't told him anything since and asked him to stop calling. Officer Sanchez then checks the serial number of Alicia's cell phone against a database of pawned cell phones and doesn't get any hits. He does the same thing with her MacBook. On September 22nd, 1 week after Alicia disappeared, Detective Sanchez visits one of Alicia's close female friends. He tells her that she's not in any trouble. I believe this friend is the same female friend that Officer Robinson visited the first day Alicia went missing. Going forward, I'm going to call her Diane. She lives less than a mile from Alicia and is Alicia's best female friend. They go to the same school, and Alicia sometimes sleeps over at her house. Detective Sanchez talks to Diane with her mother present. He asks Diane to remember the last time she talked to Alicia, which she says was on Thursday afternoon, the 12th. At 4:47 p.m. The girls texted about going to the mall, according to Diane, a plan that seems to have fallen through since they did not go to the mall that day. Sanchez then asked Diane if Alicia may have gone to meet someone from the internet. Diane says no and repeats the story about Alicia mentioning the possibility of skateboarding to California or swimming to Australia. Sanchez asked Diane where she heard this, and Diane says she heard it secondhand from Jack, a mutual friend, and one of the boys Alicia had allegedly been dating. Diane then explains that the day Alicia turned up missing, Jessica called her. Diane then texted Jack to ask if Alicia was with him, and he said no. When Jack learned from Diane that Alicia was missing, he said, quote, "Oh my God, I'm so dumb. I should have known because she talked about packing." Now here's an example of where the case file gets confusing. The case file puts that visit from Sanchez to Diane on September 22nd, exactly 1 week after Alicia disappeared. But now the case file inexplicably jumps back to September 20th, 2 days earlier. So unless this was a mistake, the following happened 2 days prior to Sanchez having that conversation with Diane, even though chronologically the police file lists it as being the next event. On September 20th, Detective Sanchez pays a visit to Jack's house at 7:20 in the evening. Jack's mother is also present, though she speaks very little English. Sanchez again tells Jack that nobody is in trouble, but he needs to find Alicia. Jack says he last spoke to Alicia 2 weeks ago by Snapchat. Sanchez asks what they talked about, and Jack says, personal stuff having to do with being boyfriend and girlfriend. Jack says he and Alicia have been dating for a while, but he broke it off either the previous Wednesday or Friday because Alicia was also dating Cody. After a few more questions Jack doesn't have the answers to, Sanchez asks Jack if Alicia is hiding in his house right now, to which Jack says she is not. Mario Sanchez then grills Jack about the supposed burner phone that Alicia had at Metro Center. Jack tells Detective Sanchez he first learned about the burner phone about a month ago, and that he and Alicia hadn't talked about it, except for her to tell him it couldn't be tracked, and she uses it to talk to her parents. Sanchez tells Jack it doesn't make any sense that Alicia would need a burner phone to talk to her parents, who had no idea it even existed, and Jack concedes that this does seem odd. Sanchez then asks Jack if he has any idea where Alicia is, and Jack repeats the story about Alicia traveling to Australia or California because Arizona's boring. Jack tells Officer Sanchez he hasn't spoken to Alicia since the breakup, which he puts on the 12th, the Thursday before Alicia disappeared. Sanchez then asks Jack for the names and addresses of Alicia's other friends, which he provides. I'll keep working my way through the case file in upcoming episodes. The Glendale Police Department has not responded to my request for comment about this case for the podcast. When I first started looking into Alicia's case in 2020, I heard a few rumors about a shadowy organization called Midnight Productions. I'm bringing it up because I think all rumors with any level of weight should be addressed, even if just to quash them and say, okay, that avenue does not need to be explored any further. People I consider respectable and credible have mentioned Midnight Productions to me, though I have yet to find anyone with knowledge willing to speak about it on the record as it might pertain to this case, which is a very different thing from acknowledging that it exists. Midnight Productions is an alleged ring of child traffickers that operates in the Phoenix area. Some sources claim it's a multi-generational family business. The ring allegedly creates and distributes pornography, including snuff films. If you do any research into Midnight Productions, you won't find mainstream news articles about it, but there are blogs, YouTube videos, and websites like Reddit where you can find enough people who seem to be telling some truth about this underground organization. There are various home addresses and people's names associated with Midnight Productions, which I won't include here because I have no way to verify that. Midnight Productions has also been loosely linked to Hell's Angels, the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department, and Child Protective Services. I personally have no reason to believe Alicia was lured by Midnight Productions or that there's any connection to her disappearance, except that I've heard it mentioned in relation to her case by several people, including one in a position of authority. There's a channel on YouTube called Tales from the Streets, in which an amateur filmmaker interviews people living on the streets all over Arizona. Almost all of the interviewees are struggling with substance abuse disorder and are unhoused. The interviewees live in cars, tents, trailers, or on the ground behind stores. They bounce between shelters, they have relationships, they steal or do odd jobs for money. The interviews are bare bones, but they're always riveting and really humanizing. If you do research online for Midnight Productions, one of the things you might find is a video of a woman who was interviewed by Tales from the Streets about 7 months ago. In this particular video, Melissa, who is 34 and in her own words, hooked on pills, leans against a fence to answer the interviewer's questions. Melissa's dark hair is pulled back in a bun. She has hoop earrings and a rosary necklace, and she's wearing a Star Wars shirt. Her eyelids droop as she answers questions and shifts back and forth on her feet. Melissa, who says she's been in and out of jail since the age of 13 when she first started smoking crack, talks openly about her issues with addiction and how it's affected her life. "I sling, I boost," Melissa answers when the interviewer asks what she does to survive on the streets. That means she sells drugs or she shoplifts. She says she also dances but tries to avoid intimate situations. Once after being up for 4 days straight, Melissa found herself drifting off at a bus stop on 25th Drive outside a strip club called Jaguars, which, for context, is about 5.5 miles from Alicia's house in Glendale. Melissa was falling asleep at the bus stop when a white man pulled up in a truck and offered her a ride. He seemed nice enough, but Melissa said she was fine, and then the man tried to force her into his truck. Melissa pulled out a needle and threatened to stab him. The man cursed her and finally drove off. She couldn't believe how normal the man had looked and the way he snapped when she declined the ride. "You can't trust white people," Melissa says. Melissa's the one to bring up Midnight Productions first. "They're satanic," she says. "They get girls messed up on drugs and lock them up. They get raped and killed. They follow you in their cars," she says. The interviewer tells Melissa that he's heard of Midnight Productions. Melissa goes on to tell him that she knows of a woman who went missing, and when the woman's brother went to the house where she was last seen to confront the woman he thought was responsible, he found a house filled with cribs and cameras arranged in what could only be described as a very disturbing fashion. I give this story credence for a few reasons, one of them being that Melissa, who has clearly seen horrible things, I don't think she has any reason to lie about this detail. The Tales from the Streets videos have no bias, no agenda, no advertising. Whether or not that woman from that story is connected to Midnight Productions, whether or not Midnight Productions ever existed or still does, it doesn't prove the organization is in any way connected to Alicia. It's my opinion that the danger of allowing something like Midnight Productions to remain a shadowy, mysterious rumor that's too taboo to even discuss and only let it exist in whispers and rumors, is that it perpetuates this image and mythology of child abuse and trafficking as something that's done in the shadows by clandestine organized gangs, rather than facing the reality that, yes, there are rings that do this, but even more commonly, it's happening in daylight, in people's own homes, by their own family, friends, and mentors. A child can be groomed online from their own bedroom by an internet predator in less than 15 minutes. The problem is real and it's prevalent. I think it would serve us to confront and get to the bottom of what Midnight Productions really is, to take some of the air out of this boogeyman theory. I think cases like Alicia's suffer if we dismiss them as being possibly related to a shadowy snuff cult because it allows us to shut a book in our minds rather than face the frightening reality that Alicia was lured by someone she trusted, someone who slowly and methodically gained her trust. Once you weed through all the rumor, information, and misinformation about Midnight Productions, you do find certain threads emerging. For example, I found more than one mention of David Hendershot while trying to find anything real to grab a hold of in this morass of rumor and innuendo about Midnight Productions. Who is David Hendershot, you ask? On April 27, 2011, Chief Deputy David Hendershot of Arizona's Maricopa County Sheriff's Office stepped down after a 6-month internal investigation that found that top aides to the sheriff had engaged in nepotism, intimidation, and abuse of power. Chief Deputy David Hendershot was previously the Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's right-hand man, prior to this high-profile ousting. That happened in 2011, The following excerpt comes from a blog post from 2012, whose author wishes to remain anonymous. Again, I'm unable to fact-check all the claims made in this post, but I'm sharing it because I've seen enough separate corroboration to believe there is some truth to this story. I'm also going to note up top that I'm reading this blog post verbatim, and it uses some terms that I would not otherwise use. This blog post makes reference to, quote, kiddie porn, which is more accurately referred to as child sexual abuse material, since porn implies a level of consent. I'm making this disclaimer since I'm using someone else's language. That said, I'm going to replace usages of, quote, kiddie porn with child sexual abuse material, because I think it in no way takes away from the meaning of the content. Okay, on to the blog post. This is what the anonymous blog post says.
I used to work in civil service for a small government research department in Phoenix, Arizona. Most of the research we did was mundane and really dull. One thing we did were studies of other departments, including the sheriff's department, headed by Joe Arpaio, the quote, toughest sheriff in America. On more than one occasion when interviewing sheriff's department employees, allegations of misconduct would come up, usually regarding drug and underage prostitution rings. In 2006, while conducting an exit after employment interview with a former sheriff's department employee, similar allegations came up, but with an added twist. The interview was basically normal, covering aspects of the job, benefits, compensation, etc. At the end, I asked interviewees if they had anything they would like to add. In this instance, the respondent seemed like he had something he wanted to add, but he was reluctant. I assured him I would respect his confidentiality, and was actually under an oath to do so, and if I did violate his confidentiality, he could file charges against me. He began to tell me there were bad things, criminal things, going on at the sheriff's department, but was reluctant to go further. I let him know I'd heard things like that in the past, and even prompted him by saying, "You're talking about the drug rings and prostitution rings." He then said, "Yes, but that's not all of it. They make movies in these old warehouses out in Scottsdale." After my somewhat blasé but friendly response, he went on to say that these movies were using little kids, by which he did not mean teenagers. He also mentioned a specific, highly placed person in the sheriff's department. A few months later, I was visiting with an old friend and one of his buddies. During the course of the conversation, I mentioned an incident where the sheriff's department had given me a copy of the blueprints to the new jail to use as a map, because they were tired of providing me with an armed escort when I had to go down there. I thought this was really stupid of them and joked about selling it on eBay. My friend's buddy then began asking me what I knew about the sheriff's department and things I'd heard. When I asked for specifics, he replied, "Criminal activities." I told him about the drug and teenage prostitution rings, which were basically common knowledge on the street. He asked me if I heard anything about anything in Scottsdale, and I said that I did. Something about movies being shot in warehouses out there. He then said, "Did I know what kind of movies?" And I said, "What I heard was child sexual abuse material, but you hear all kinds of things." And then he said really loudly, "It's not just child sexual abuse material, it's child snuff porn." This was a bit much for me, and I looked over at my friend as if to say, "Is he for real?" And all my friend said was, "It's true." Then as he was going on about it, he said, "Do you know who's behind it?" And before I could say anything, he blurted out the same name the ex-employee had. The last reference to the child sexual abuse material, movies, came while visiting a friend of one of my neighbors. We'd gone over there to, quote, party. When the neighbor's friend found out where I worked, he was at first suspicious, since contraband herbal party supplies were in evidence, then after a while became more comfortable. He asked me what I knew about the sheriff's department and also the witness protection program, and could I get a hold of someone for him. Upon me asking why he wanted to know stuff, he then went into a long tale about his cousin who was a law enforcement officer who was involved in a case that involved law enforcement and federal judges. And he provided me with some very gruesome details about special movies being made that involved very small children and infants, grown-ups, strange costumes, and snuff killing. His cousin supposedly had entered witness protection program. No one ever went to trial, and he hadn't heard from her since. He wanted to know if I could get a message to his cousin. The movies, he mentioned at one point, were filmed in some old warehouses, and he also mentioned the name of the sheriff's department employee. He has also mentioned that his cousin, who had been very badly affected by this, had been persuaded to stay on the case because of her inn. Supposedly, this was something she stumbled on while doing undercover work investigating cocaine smuggling. I heard the same story from three different sources that I seriously doubt knew each other. One of the deputies whose name came up in connection with the things described above was David Hendershot, who, when he retired at full pension, was rehired the next day in a new position at over $150,000 a year in addition to his pension. His son, by the same name, is also a sheriff's department employee. Hendershot was found to have been hiring friends to work for the sheriff's department without having them do much actual work.
I'm going to break from the blog post here just to point out that the anonymous blog poster supported this story with several links to actual news articles.
Hendershot was fired in 2011 based on the findings of a six-month probe conducted by Pinal County Sheriff Paul Babu into allegations including mismanagement, nepotism, and obstruction of a criminal investigation. Babu's investigation was triggered by a 63-page internal memo detailing a long list of questionable behavior among top sheriff's office employees. Despite his public fall from grace during the scandal, Hendershot now works as a private investigator, offering products and services which includes, among other things, child abduction recovery. Hendershot lost his job and was vilified in the press for engaging in various forms of corruption, but he was never questioned regarding his knowledge of the abuse of adults and children and their use in possible snuff films. These are the crimes that go uninvestigated and unpunished because exposing them would expose the rotten core of the justice system itself.
It sounds like David Hendershot, senior and junior, are definitely people I need to try to get in touch with. I would love to be able to close the book on Midnight Productions as it pertains to Alicia's case, and in order to do that, I need to learn more about it. Whether it indeed still exists, who's running it, and if it could have any connection to this case or not. I believe it still exists in some iteration. Whether it's got the same members or not, and I'm pretty sure it's undergone a rebranding and is likely no longer called Midnight Productions. I also don't want to devote too much time to it in this show, because Midnight Productions is just one thread of so many. But if you do have information about Midnight Productions, I would love to hear your tips. I know it's a long shot, but I would love to be able to either find a solid connection or rule it out. So you can reach out to me at gonefromglendale@gmail.com. In future episodes, I'll continue trying to connect the dots, track down people to interview from Alicia's orbit, and take listeners through the remainder of the case file. If you have any information about the disappearance of Alicia Navarro, please call the Glendale, Arizona Police Department at 623-930-3000, the Anti-Predator Project at 305-796-4859, or you can email me, Alyssa Fleck, at gonefromglendale@gmail.com. If you think you see Alicia, please call 911 immediately.